Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the main event. The following podcast will take you back in time to rewind and relive all things retro in wrestling. It's time to go old school. This is Beyond the Bell.
Before God and my father as witness, I declare the franchise as the new ECW Heavyweight Champion of the World! So tonight, let the new era begin. The era of the sport of professional wrestling. The era of the franchise. The era of the ECW.
Welcome back, extreme old school students, to the old school wrestling podcast that takes you back in time to rewind and relive all things retro in wrestling. Yes, this is Beyond the Bell, which is powered by the SNS Radio Network, and I'm your host, your personal ring announcer, Sean Beckerman. Class is in session. Once again, students of Beyond the Bell, ECW 101 is here and class is in session. We take you now to Chapter 2, the years 1994 and 1995 in the history of Extreme Championship Wrestling. On August 27th, 1994, Eastern Championship Wrestling was born anew as Extreme Championship Wrestling. Let the new era begin in professional wrestling. And with an exclamation point that sent shockwaves throughout the wrestling world, it announced its radical intentions of expanding nationwide. The land of extreme was now born in Extreme Championship Wrestling. A large group of independent promoters had banded together in an effort to relaunch the NWA, which was at one time the most prestigious wrestling alliance in the entire world. Naturally, they sought to capitalize on the popularity of the hottest indie in the country and embraced ECW as one of their charter member organizations. They organized a tournament to crown a new world champion. The All-ECW Finals, of which occurred on that blistering August night in Philadelphia, took place. It pitted Shane Douglas against Too Cold Scorpio. After Douglas won the title, he launched into the tirade that we played at the top of the program. He threw down the NWA title in an action of symbolism, which was not lost on anyone, and led the crowd in a Flair is Dead chant. The other NWA promoters, including New Jersey's late Dennis Coraluzio, were incensed and shocked by the act of blasphemy by the franchise Shane Douglas. Nonetheless, Extreme Championship Wrestling had arrived, and the wrestling business would never be the same again.
I stand here before God and my Father in heaven tonight
As I said, I would be World Heavyweight Champion. In the tradition of Lou Thesz, in the tradition of Jack Briscoe, of the Briscoe Brothers, of Dory Funk Jr., of Terry Funk, the man who'll never die. The real nature boy, Buddy Rogers, upstairs tonight. From the Harley races to the Barry Windhams to the Ric Flairs. Rhodes. This is it tonight, Dad. God, that's beautiful. And Rick Steamboat. And they can all kiss my ass.
What in the hell is he doing?
Because I am not the man who accepts a torch to be handed down to me from an organization that died, R.I.P., 7 years ago. The franchise, Shane Douglas, is the man who ignites the new flame of the sport of professional wrestling.
That's the ECW
tonight,
belt.
Before God and my father as witness, I declare myself, the franchise, as the new ECW heavyweight champion of the world.
Shane Douglas declaring himself.
We have set out
ECW
to change
world
the
champion
of professional wrestling. So tonight, let the new era begin. The era of the sport of professional wrestling. The era of the franchise. The era of the ECW.
We're trying to come up with a new name, and we're thinking about using the same letters. And Paul turned to me one day and he said, "You ever hear the word extreme?" I said, "Well, yeah, I've heard the word. Why?" He said, "Because in 2 years, you're going to hear it everywhere."
You know, now all the rage in extreme sports, it was now here was extreme wrestling, so it was an appropriate name.
I trusted him, and it got extreme.
That was my style. That's what I wanted to do. So I was glad to see it go that way because I never saw myself as your Ricky Steamboat technical kind of wrestler guy.
It was tougher, and it looked more genuine. It looked more real than the other federations.
As now the notorious ECW continued to grow, so too did its rebel image, so too did its budget, and so too did its ability to secure the services of world-class talents. In came Cactus Jack, a.k.a. Mick Foley, a man whose reputation as one of the best all-around performers in the business preceded him. Several months prior to Douglas's outburst, Jack had validated his status as an extreme favorite by wrestling and losing to Sabu at the ECW arena while still employed by WCW as one half of its resident tag team championship combination. What's more, Jack delivered a forceful post-match interview during which he spit on his WCW championship belt and put over the superior quality of ECW's product. After departing from WCW under less than amicable circumstances, he became a full-fledged member of ECW's roster in September of 1994. His debut at the arena marked the first of his many famous gory ECW battles with his buddy in brassy bloodletting, Terry Funk. He briefly parted ways with the company because he was offended by Douglas's outburst against the NWA, but he returned, once again, to go after Cactus Jack. Heyman continued to ratchet up the violence to an unprecedented degree, but he also demonstrated his deep appreciation for more traditional type of work rate by introducing an influx of world-class performers to ECW. Chris Benoit and Dean Malenko, two of the best technical wrestlers in the world, arrived simultaneously in September of 94 as well. Benoit feuded with Sabu from the very first start, while Malenko was embroiled in a series of hotly contested TV title matches with Scorpio and others. In 95, another wrestler debuted who possessed credentials as a top-flight worker, a gringo loco named Eddie Guerrero. He was followed forthwith by the world's most spectacular high flyer, Rey Mysterio Jr., along with a man who could have then staked a legitimate claim to being the closest rival for that distinction, Psicosis. The equally skilled Juventud Guerrera joined them later on, as did their intermediary of sorts, Conan. Unquestionably, the best wrestling action in the world was now occurring before approximately 1,000 fans every month in a converted bingo hall. In addition to featuring the most advanced wrestling, the most violence, and the most raunch of any promotion in the country, ECW was also characterized by the best booked feuds and most revolutionary angles in the business. Most notably, Heyman and Company popularized what became commonly known as shoot angles. These were storylines designed to convince even jaded viewers that a given series of events were real. The greatest artistic triumph of the early shoot angle involved Tommy Dreamer and the Sandman. In the midst of 1994 mainstream media outbreak regarding the practice of caning in Singapore, this led to the Sandman carrying a Singapore cane to the ring, and alongside manager Woman, they literally thrashed his opponents with the foreign object.
I was getting booed. I was a babyface doing running and getting heat. Not heat because you did something that they hated. The heat because you sucked.
Obviously, my relationship with Sandman was unique, so I guess seeing him evolve to a guy who came out smoking cigarettes and drinking beer, which pulled my word over until I finally won, because I said, it is still my money.
And Todd's like, listen, well, why don't you just go out and let him be hacked? You know, Paul's like, what do you mean? He goes, well, let it started out with a cigarette. He goes, let him go out with a cigarette. So for a couple months, I just came out with a cigarette. And then I would sit in the back. I'd have a 30-pack of beer. I'd be drinking beer. And then one day, Todd got Paul to let me come out with a beer. And then the Sandman character was really hit. You know what I mean?
You can relate to a man who walks to the ring drinking beer and smoking a cigarette.
He'd be one of the guys my uncle would like who I wouldn't imagine my uncle would like because he drinks and smokes. But see, that's him.
Love Sandman. One of the smartest guys I've ever met. Now, when I first met him, I thought he was just a drunk. I mean, I thought I was a drunkard when I got there. But, you know, here's a guy with a gallon of milk in one hand, a bottle of vodka in the other, and a case of beer constantly going. But as I got to know him, I found just a brilliant guy. And Sandman and I would often hole up in a room, and people would think we were probably up to all sorts of debauchery, but we really weren't. We'd sit in a room all night and play the equivalent of Jeopardy or something. So instead of screwing rats and doing drugs like everybody probably assumed we were doing, a night of me and Sandman hanging together was,
yo, red guy, I want you to think of a country below the 38th parallel, and it's a dictatorship.
Czechoslovakia.
Perfect! How'd you know that? Okay, what was the dictator's name? Ceausescu. Red guy! How'd you know that? Perfect!
Sit up and play trivia all day and night, but really smart guy, a lot of love for the game, and he's a guy I'd pick a bullet for. I love him.
I think he's trying to pickle himself. I don't know. You could put him in a mason jar and he'll last for years.
Sandman is the prototypical functional drunk.
And you know what the interesting thing is? Tremendous family man. Like, you know, a drunken menace to society on the weekends. During the week, he's like the greatest dad you ever saw. Doesn't drink, sits at home, you know, with his kids. Just a phenomenal father. I mean, complete dichotomy.
Sandman is the first man that I've ever seen walk into any wrestling business and have absolutely not 1 ounce of wrestling ability. None. And get over like he does.
Now I love Pac like to death, but there was a time that if I had a gun, I would have shot him between the eyes. And we always talk about it. Like, remember when we hated each other?
He'll give you the shirt off his back if he had to. If he needed it, he'd give it to you.
And he's one of the alumni of the VCW. And once again, I ain't got a bad word to say about him. Alcoholic drug addict, but nothing other than nothing.
I'm looking for something different to do. Nobody else comes through the crowd, you know what I mean? So I was just looking for something different to do. So I would come out from different places in the building, you know what I mean? Instead of everybody looking down the runway, I'd like to come in through the front door.
If you've never seen the Sandman entrance in ECW Arena, you're missing out on something really special.
When his music came on at Enter Sandman by Metallica, the whole place came to its feet and this electricity came.
And then you just look at the sea of people all start to turn around. And it like flows across the building. Everybody turns around to see. And then you stick your cane up and then the place explodes, you know? It was a great, great feeling, you know? Terry Funk again, kid, you gotta do something different to separate yourself.
Sandman is the drunken fans with a cigarette in their mouth, drinking and smoking cigarettes. Tommy's like the actual, you know, is like the Mark fan that could never do it. And Sandman's the drunken guy who sits on his couch and goes, I could do that. Except they know they can, but he's just a little tougher, a little more psychotic, and a little drunker, and he can do it. But, I mean, those two really epitomize ECW.
He and Dreamer were involved in an intense feud, the climax of which was to be an I Quit match at the ECW Arena in October. During the bout, as Sandman lit a cigarette, Dreamer shoved it in his eye and proceeded to cane him across the face, accidentally rendering him blind. Tommy immediately broke kayfabe, so to speak, and implored woman with cries of, I didn't mean it, I didn't mean to do it. As Heyman and a group of paramedics carted the Sandman off, the tragic victim, away from the ring on a gurney, landed the Sandman. The scene was so convincing that many members of the jaded ECW fan base in the arena showed legitimate concern. On a subsequent show, Woman announced that she would no longer manage the Sandman. For his part, Dreamer tearfully dedicated his career to his former foe and wrestled while carrying a sympathetic look to him in the ring. He seemed confused. Tommy Dreamer was lost. At the next month's ECW Arena card, Joey Styles was conducting a farewell interview with the bandaged, scarred, and now impaired Sandman. At this time, Peaches came out, the beer-guzzling hardcore hero's estranged wife. She came to the ring and mended fences with her real-life husband. Woman, keen in tow, interrupted the quasi-sentimental reunion by paddling Peaches into the mat with the cane and threatening to do the same to the helpless Sandman. The ever-naive Tommy Dreamer, fueled by his overwhelming pangs of guilt, rushed to the ring for the save. With Dreamer's back turned, Sandman removed his bandages, grabbed the cane, and shockingly broke it over Dreamer's head. Having successfully consummated their elaborate plot, Woman and the Sandman left Dreamer lying in a pool of blood. This left the crowd in a state of hardcore bliss because of the brilliant, groundbreaking storyline. It got the fans. They were hooked.
Welcome back to Extreme Championship Wrestling. It was just a few nights ago, this past Saturday night, as part of the second annual November to Remember, that a turnaway crowd gathered at the ECW Arena in South Philadelphia to say farewell to a man who epitomized Extreme Championship, who epitomized hardcore wrestling, the Sandman. We now take you to a critical moment in that retirement ceremony for the Sandman.
Tommy Cairo, I almost ended your career.
Well, here comes
you could
that's
never
Peaches.
Give her what I gave her.
What's she doing here?
Kiss you on the lips.
You've changed peaches. I don't care how fat you've gotten. I don't care how much weight you put on, peaches. All's I know is,
Sandman,
you are the most important thing that I've lost. I can see it now, peaches. You are the most important thing that I've lost in this whole situation.
Well, excuse.
Oh no. Sucker us all.
Aside from the Dreamer Sandman Woman Peaches saga, ECW also ushered in a number of other ingeniously booked angles. As disciplined and well-paced as they were imaginative, the influence of many of these storylines is still discernible to this very day. And now we'll discuss a couple of those storylines that made such an impact in the professional wrestling industry. Throughout 1994, 911 was ECW's official mascot, so to speak, and a symbolic emissary of the fans' anti-Big Two sentiments. As the largest man in the company, he invariably chokeslammed every former WCW and WWF wrestler who passed through the company. Names like Mr. Hughes, Ron Simmons, and Marty Jannetty. But let's not fail to mention Woman, of course, referees, timekeepers, Santa Claus, and a host of other wrestlers and other ancillary characters. Real name Al Pollig, he was perhaps the most over character in the promotion for a period of several months. He did this by using his choke slam that inspired the Giant to adopt the move as a finisher in WCW in 1995. Unfortunately, 911 was never able to make the transition from gimmick performer status, one with tremendous popularity, to serious title contender status, and left the promotion on poor terms in late 1995. This was before making a few short-lived returns. He also received national exposure as WCW jobber Big Al in 1997 on Monday Nitro. Also in mid-1994, Heyman cast a 19-year-old, exceptionally unimposing, one-time member of the ECW ring crew named Mikey Whipwreck as a lucky, lovable loser who was demolished by the other wrestlers on a weekly basis. He hated holding titles because of the beatings, doing so as a result of being champion. After several weeks of steady jobbing, Mikey miraculously toppled the Pitbull to capture the ECW TV title on May 13, 1994, in one of the luckiest wins in wrestling history. He reluctantly held the title for the following 3 months. Next, he and Cactus Jack won the ECW tag team titles from Public Enemy, but only after Rocco Rock received an especially damaging crotch shot and tripped over the unconscious Whipwreck and ended up in a pinning predicament. Their reign lasted several months as well. Finally, Whipwreck completed the trifecta of title triumphs on October 28, 1995, by conquering the Sandman in an ECW title ladder match. Oh my God, Joey Styles exclaimed. Mikey Whipwreck was ECW champion. One of my personal favorites was Matt Born Again Born, who was one of several wrestlers cast as Doink the Clown in the World Wrestling Federation. He adopted a split personality persona for which half of his face was decked out in Doink the Clown makeup and the other half featured no embellishments whatsoever. He was Matt Bond. Of course, Bond eventually received a chokeslam from 911, prompting Styles, whose announcing was head and shoulders above everyone else in this period, one clown down, Bischoff and McMahon to go. Ultimately, Heyman fired Bond after he asked permission to work a show for ECW rival Dennis Carluzio's NWA. To me, I love the character of Bond again. It was revolutionary for its time. You could say, in a sense, the precursor to the Joker character, which everybody loved in the new Batman series.
You gotta stay close to your enemies. Didn't make a lot of sense to me when he first told me that, but as I thought about it and as I looked at the enemies around me, I understood what he was saying. You see, if you stay close to your enemies, you're gonna know where they're at. You're gonna know what they're thinking because they're gonna talk to you because you're close to them. And that's the same concept I used with Two Court Schofield. He is my enemy, but I let him think that he was on top of everything. Oh, yeah, he's a phenomenal wrestler. He comes flying pillar to post. Oh, yeah, you never know when he's going to kick you in the mouth. It happens. But what happened is I shared a little bit of myself. You know, Like I said, stay close to your enemies. I want to share myself with you, poor Scorpio. You see, he felt a little bit of what I felt. You know, all bunched up. All several, many, many years. Bunched right together. I gave him right to Scorpio there and let him feel a little bit of that emotion. You see, there's a lot of guys out there wanting to be Doink. Doink who? Who is it? Everybody wants to be a Doink. There's several of them. There's many of them out there. But there's only one. There's only one real one. There's only one original. But I'm not Doink. I'm not Doink, no. Whoever said I was Doink? Ah, man. But Dukort Scorpio, you know, I feel like I've really done something. I really have accomplished something here. I've let you feel what other people have felt. I mean, not too many people get that opportunity now, you know? To know where somebody's coming from, to feel that hell. To feel that, oh, maybe once in a while a bit of pleasure comes along, but it's really hell. How's it feel? Oh, hell can be really hell, can it? You know, I feel so good about it, though, Scorpio. You know, I was going to dig in and grab out a bunch of tricks out of my bag, but why give you everything at once, you know? I just give you a little taste. What do you want now? Live in the hell a little bit longer, because I know you have dreams. Oh, I bet you they're sweet, nasty, ugly dreams, too. Yes, I feel so good. Oh, my goodness, I feel born again.
During a late 1994 match that pitted Sabu against Chris Benoit, we saw the former Crippler suffer a stinger in his neck while bumping on a back body drop. Heyman played off for the legitimate injury by having Benoit dub himself the Canadian Crippler. He gloated about his accomplishment during interviews. In fact, it was during these promos that Benoit demonstrated his potential to develop somewhat decent mic skills to complement his peerless work rate at the time. The Crippler subsequently injured a series of other wrestlers, including Rocco Rock and Al Snow, when he transitioned in ECW in 1995. At the time, it just so happened that Heyman was grooming Benoit to win the ECW title, but the fickle forces of fate intervened, and Benoit was off to World Championship Wrestling. The franchise Shane Douglas, the centerpiece of ECW's early expansion attempts, did a series of shoot interviews, you could say, on ECW television regarding real-life enemies Ric Flair, Shawn Michaels, and Hulk Hogan, among others. Once, Douglas even did a 30-minute interview on ECW TV that would have made any shoot interviewer proud. He ripped into anyone and everyone who had ever raised his ire in the wrestling business. This stemmed from the tremendous response these segments received from the fans. Heyman concocted an ill-fated storyline of having a succession of former Flair Four Horsemen colleagues invade ECW in an effort to silence the insilent Douglas. After a few poorly received Douglas vs. Tully Blanchard matches, however, he ditched the idea. But those were the notable feuds that put ECW on the map in early 94 and 95.
Do you want to see Hogan and Flair? Do you want to see the franchise Shane Douglas without the goddamn handcuffs? Without the gag? To say whatever I want to say.
One of the best promos ever.
He'll take it till he can't take it no more, and then he'll let you know, and then he'll get mad, like, fuck you and fuck your mama and fuck this, that, and the other, and then later on, he'll be like, well, maybe I shouldn't have done that. He'll be like, well, fuck it, I've done this all over, fuck it, it's done. You know what I'm saying? Shane sells tickets.
Hulk Hogan, you can't suck my dick. You can't hold the franchise's dark trap, because I am what this sport is about, and you are a caricature. From the 1980s, you suck dead, and you suck now!
When you look at the franchise character and you see Troy Martin, and people that have seen Troy Martin's temper blow know that that's real close down that scale of, you know, even-tempered and pissed off. That's Troy Martin pissed off times 10.
Shane is the man, in my opinion, who gave ECW their identity.
Shane was just an incredibly talented, just this great, young, good-looking babyface who just got fed up with the system, and then and it worked for him.
You know, my dad was an old World War II veteran, always taught me that, you know, you can always be like everybody else. It's easy to be mediocre. It's easy to be middle of the road. It's easy to be non-controversial. But all the successful people in the world, he went through, you know, my dad used to talk to me about the scientists and the warriors and, you know, all the different people throughout history that made it. These were always people that took chances. Our good friend Mike Tenay called me up and had me on his radio program and said, "Have you heard what Dennis Corluzzo said about you?" At this point, I'd never met Dennis Corluzzo. I'd never heard of his name. I didn't know him from Adam. I had no idea who the guy was, except that I did know that he was associated with the NWA. And I had heard that he was telling people that they shouldn't book me. And at this time, remember, outside bookings for us were very important because the ECW was running maybe once a month at that point. And here was a guy that I had no dealings with, had no idea who he was. Suddenly he's going out and telling people on today's radio show not to book me, that I'm unreliable, that I took pay from him and never showed up for him. I mean, it was really some pretty slanderous stuff he was saying about me. It was going to really have a negative effect on my bottom line. So when Paul Heyman took this idea that Corluzzo had about building this NWA out of ECW, Paul came up with the idea of using it as a swerve, what we call in the business a swerve. Build it to that point, let Dennis Corluzzo and the NWA think it's going to be their night, and all of a sudden the franchise pulls the rug out from underneath them and it's ECW's night. And I'll give Paul Heyman credit. Paul Heyman and I have a lot of differences over the way ECW finished out and the way he treated the guys, and, you know, that's a whole other story. But I will say this, Paul Heyman, when it came to that point, you know, if you work for Vince McMahon, as you all know, Vince would say, "Shane, tonight you're going to do A, B, and C. And you either do it or you go home or get starved or something." Paul Heyman had called me for several weeks prior to this, and, you know, every time he talked to me about it, he would go over what he thought were the positives, what he thought were the negatives, you know, any question I wanted to ask of him. The only two people that were aware that night of going into it that there was even a possibility that that was going to happen were me and Paul Heyman.
For one, the NWA, for all intents and purposes at that point, was just a bunch of indie guys running around. And in many ways it is today, with the exception of TNA. It's a bunch of indie guys running around going, "We're a part of the NWA." You know, it's, with all due respect to them, they're indie guys. When you're drawing 60 to 75 people, you do not have any political stroke.
As I recall, I remember just how much it angered me. But here's this guy coming, and he kept going, "Hey, buddy, sign this contract, but it's going to be great to have you on board as our champion, buddy." Meanwhile, 2 weeks prior to that, he's burying me on today's national radio program, telling everybody not to book me. And it just sickened me that these, you know, that two-facedness of the business is something I've never liked, never been able to swallow it, will never like it. And there it was on display for me firsthand. And that's what really emboldened me to go ahead and go through with the idea of throwing that belt down.
Shane wins the NWA World Heavyweight title. And he dedicates it to his father who had passed away, which is, just awesome. And cuts one of his great promos.
Whenever I'm in the ring that night, I take the microphone and I stop, and there's a pause. You know, some people say it was like a dramatic pause. There wasn't. I was stopping and thinking to myself, do I do this or not? And when I look up to heaven and say, my dad had died right prior to that, in October of 93. And I looked up to heaven and I said, "Here we go, Dad." Because that was me telling him, this is the first time as a man I had the opportunity to put this into practice. And come hell or high water, whether it was for better or for worse, and that's when I take the belt and I stop and I do the long promo about, you know, the tradition of the Dusty Rhodes and the Real Nature Boys, and yes, the Ric Flairs and the Ricky Steamboats and yada, yada, yada. And that's where I pause and I stop and I look up and I say, "Here we go, Dad," and they can all kiss my ass. And I throw the belt down.
Now, when that NWA title belt hit the mat, it was like, holy shit, I just saw something that probably wasn't supposed to happen.
Holy shit, man. He just threw the belt down. That's going to be some heat.
It's a tremendous angle. And then he takes the ECW belt, the Eastern Championship Wrestling belt, and proclaims himself the ECW Heavyweight Champion of the World. And from there, we became Extreme Championship Wrestling, ECW, and we created our own World Heavyweight title. The problem is the NWA didn't know about this. So the NWA was double-crossed. Dennis Corluzzo and the NWA were up in arms.
When I did that, Corluzzo was sitting at ringside, camera right, my left. And I see Corluzzo look at Todd Gordon and looks back at me, and, you know, he still doesn't realize what's going on. And that was the beauty of it. Even as I'm cutting the promo, as I'm burying the NWA and hoisting up the ECW banner and the new name, and the fans are popping, and everybody's jumping up and down, and Todd is sitting next to him, trying to convince him it's just part of the show. Just relax and stay the course.
All I remember is sitting next to this guy, who's biting his finger, and he's going, "Hey, man, he's pissing on the belt. he's pissing on the belt. I said, oh, no, don't worry, it's an angle. He goes, no, man, he's pissing on the belt. I said, I don't think so. I said, just listen to him.
I kind of felt bad for Dennis because I knew Dennis, but at the same time, it was some interesting things going on that night.
Went in the back, and he said, what are we going to do? I said, don't worry about it. I said, here's what you do. You threaten to suspend Eastern Championship Wrestling from the NWA if Shane doesn't defend the belt. He has to defend that NWA belt or we're out.
Some other notable events in 1984 included the night the line was crossed. Shane Douglas versus Terry Funk versus Sabu, February 5th, 1994. The original three-way dance, although it wasn't referred to as such at the time, was a one-hour-long match that put the cartoon shows that masqueraded as professional wrestling of the time to shame. Between the blow-away effort of the three wrestlers, Heyman's booking had fans going with a match that told a story in creating the storylines that moved along the three pivotal characters of the golden era of ECW.
You know, in 30 years, there's a certain number of matches that are memorable, really memorable matches to me. And one of them's the three-way dance. Sabu and Shane and I and Paulie and a combination of the three of us that came up with the idea of the three-way dance. I wouldn't give that credit to, nor try to take credit for that.
I didn't go into the match, and I don't think they did either, saying, wow, we're going to really set the wrestling world on fire after this match. I think we just went out to do our job. We try to set the wrestling world on fire every night.
I think it was a great concept that was came up with, and we were trying to figure out some way to go in there and do something different.
It's an odd match, you know, because you got Terry Funk, who's like really old school, you know, and even though he can do, you know, moonsaults at his age and stuff, you know, and then you got Shane, who's a traditional type wrestler, and then you got Sabu, who's, you know, crazy out of the ring, in the ring. I mean, he just does crazy things.
I don't think anybody really knew what to expect, because at the time, a three-way was unlike anything anybody had ever seen in the United States before.
The three of us talked about it, and we came up with that idea and then went into the three-way dance, which was one of the classic ECW shows of all time.
Right before that three-way went on, I remember Paul kneeling on the ground almost like he was praying, which, if you know Paul Heyman, I don't think he's done a lot of praying in his life, and Todd Gordon going up to him and kind of patting him on the back, you know, going, hey, Paul, what's the matter? And Paul just looking up at Todd and going, this match is either going to make me or break me.
I'm not really fond of giving credit to Shane, but they started that dadgum match and went about 15 minutes before I came to the ring. And believe me, they had the crowd right whenever I got there for that last 45 minutes of that match.
At roughly 15 minutes in, Sabu got hurt and got taken to the back.
The only one that really went 60 minutes was Shane. I didn't do 60 minutes.
So Terry Funk and Sabu basically did 40, 45 minutes each. I did the entire hour, so which was by design. Paul wanted the franchise character to be that new world champion that could do the one-hour Broadway.
It brought three different types of wrestling worlds together, you know. A three-way is really hard to come, is really hard to pull off.
It was the creativity in the dance that began, and it was a wonderful dance.
What made that match special is it was the first time in forever in professional wrestling in the U.S. where you had a one-hour match, and they went bell to bell, and beyond that, you had a guy, a veteran, Terry Funk, I don't want to say carrying, but helping to make new stars in Sabu and Shane Douglas.
It got out of control in every way, and the fans loved it. They really loved it. They really loved it.
You know, there was a subtle round of applause and the fans, and then, you know, as I'm laying there catching my breath, I started looking around, and Sherry Martel was the one that actually alerted me to it first. She went, oh, my God. And I was lying here, and she was standing there, so I looked at her like, I didn't know there was a fan jumping over the railing or what was going on. And I looked up at her, and then she said that, I started looking around, and that's when I realized the fans coming to this ovation.
When the match ended, I just stood up and gave a standing ovation and applauded for about five minutes. I was sitting right by the rail as the wrestlers came by. I high-fived them, and after the show, I would wait for my friend George, and I saw the wrestlers, you know, hanging around the building, and I went up to each one of them and said, wow, that was one of the greatest matches I ever saw in my life. You guys, that was awesome.
That was the payoff. It certainly wasn't what Paulie handed us at the end of the night. The payoff was the fans. The payoff was the ECW group, their tightness. It was, they also evolved that night. They evolved into a wonderful, wonderful cult and following. And we love them as much as they loved us.
An April 16th ECW Arena angle saw Arn Anderson and Bobby Eaton do a run-in that resulted in one of the loudest pops in the ECW Arena history. A run-in that was kept 100% quiet to those pre-internet days. So quiet that some of the workers and staff had no clue what was going on either. The October-November 1994 Sandman Blinding angle, like we mentioned, was voted Wrestling Observer Angle of the Year. Some of the other names seen in the ECW Arena during 1994 were, of course, 911, Mr. U, Sal Palomo, Tommy Cairo, The Sandman, Gary Wolfe, Matt Bond, Ray Odyssey, The Public Enemy, which consisted of Rocco Rock and Johnny Grunge, The Sheik, Pat Tanaka, Road Warrior Hawk, The Bruise Brothers, and Mike Awesome. 1995 arrives for ECW, Extreme Championship Wrestling. As part of one entertaining sequence of events, Douglas defended his ECW title against the Sandman in April of 95 when Woman handed Douglas the caning stick. Douglas used it to win the match and promptly embraced Woman as his new companion. In a rematch at the next arena show, the cunning, villainous Vixen cost Douglas the title by clubbing him in the leg, allowing Sandman to win the match and his first ECW title. Hence, the pair had designed the previous show's efforts as a ploy to get Douglas to lend his guard down at an opportune moment. The franchise promptly grabbed a microphone, denounced ECW and its fans, put on a Monday Night Raw shirt, and vowed, "Now I'm going someplace where I can wrestle." He departed a few months later for an ill-starred Titan tenure at the time, known as Dean Douglas. This was not long before continuing to spew his anti-hardcore diatribe. At one ECW Arena show, he claimed to have reported the excessive violence in ECW to the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commissioner, one of ECW's NWA enemies, actually had. The commission had accordingly assigned toothless 70s and 80s NWA referee Bill Alfonso to implement law and order. In mid-1995, Cactus Jack turned heel by portraying the absolute anti-hardcore, anti-ECW wrestler. Based on his real-life reservations about the ruthless, bloodthirsty nature of many ECW fans, Jack conducted a classic series of interviews during which he basically castrated Tommy Dreamer's loyalty to them and the company. He then encouraged Dreamer to accept a contract offer from the hated Eric Bischoff. It seemed as if Jack had abandoned his reckless brawling style, and in a trick that drew massive heat from the ECW audience, started packing his matches with heaps of headlocks and hammerlocks, boring the ECW faithful. The crescendo came when Dreamer pulled a homemade Bischoff shirt over Cactus's head and smashed it with a chair, thereby creating the illusion that the innovator of violence had just obliterated WCW's despised VP himself. ECW also saw the emergence of Stevie Richards. He, of the Daisy Duke shorts and dorky disposition fame, adopted a pseudo-Johnny Polo gimmick and participated in a series of vignettes vowing to bring the real Johnny Polo to ECW. And shortly thereafter, we saw the debut of Scott Levy at the ECW Arena in January of 1995 as Raven debuted, a grungy, moody, disaffected Gen Xer who, dressed as a pseudo-gothic, spoke with eloquence and intelligence on the microphone. As he quoted from Edgar Allan Poe, quote the Raven, "Nevermore." He won his matches with the Even Flow DDT. It was perhaps the most effective character in the 9-year history of the company. And with his terrific, over-the-top portrayal of the geeky flunky, Stevie Richards only augmented the success of Raven. The most involved feud in ECW commenced in February of 1995 when, after Richards lost a series of matches to Raven's childhood friend, Tommy Dreamer, Raven expressed discontentment with Richards' performance. Before long, Raven and Dreamer started having regular physical altercations of their very own. They also engaged in their very first singles match at the March 1995 ECW Arena show. Auxiliary performers like Beulah McGillicuddy, Francine, and even for a brief time, Luna Vachon, whose signature hold was the twisting, turning, churning, grinding groin claw, arrived in 95 to play an integral part in the intricate proceedings of this feud. After suffering a few defeats early in the program, Raven went on a winning streak of sorts, and it did not end until June of 1997. In the process, he inflicted constant physical and psychological abuse on the innovator of violence.
Tommy Dreamer is one of the guys that wasn't really given enough credit for up there because he held things together a lot. You know, Tommy dipped into his own wallet and tried to keep things going. You know, he loved the business so much.
Tommy Dreamer, if this gets people mad at him, I'm sorry, but I love him. I admire a guy who did what he did to himself for something he loved.
Tommy is a really great guy. He's a true friend, and that's one thing you can't find in this wrestling business is a true friend.
I mean, he wanted so desperately to learn how to be a better wrestler. I remember at the beginning there when he first was being pushed there, and he just couldn't get over the way, you know, the suspenders and all that, and he just couldn't get any traction with the fans. It wasn't until the Raven angle that the fans really bought into him, and he took that beating and just kept going back for more.
The feud that he had with Raven, of course, the ultimate underdog.
He actually wanted to die in the ring. He actually figured if he was going to ever die, like if he had ever got AIDS or something, that he would much rather die in the ring and have like me kill him in the ring, you know, because it would be much more, you know, dramatic, you know, ECW style.
Tommy and I, you know, we've been through a lot together, and he's good to work with, and very professional guy, he's got a good mind for the business.
Tommy was ECW. You know, everyone thinks Paul Heyman's ECW. To me, it was Paul Heyman's and Tommy's ECW, especially towards the end once Todd left.
He was one of the reasons that ECW lasted as long as it did, and in the ring performer, he was great. And a lot of people didn't even know that, you know. And to this day, a lot of people have forgotten what a great in-ring performer Tommy Dreamer is. Just a great performer.
Cactus Jack is another guy. I don't think without him, ECW would have gotten as far as it did. And by the same token, I don't think Cactus would have made it to WWF without ECW.
Mick Foley was, and I don't want to be repetitive, but he's another guy who broke his back for those ECW fans.
Just an absolute wonderful mind on that boy.
His promos when he was doing the anti-hardcore stuff to this day, still the best stuff, the best promos ever, I think, in wrestling history. He would make you laugh, and he would make you go, well, this guy's out of his mind. You would actually believe he was nuts.
He always went one level higher than those fans thought that he could go.
A lot of the stuff he did with Mr. Sacco later, you would see some of that silliness of Mikey Whipwreck in the early days of ECW. You know, and some of the silliness that he would pull as Mankind. You got to see the beginnings of that as the anti-hardcore Cactus Jack.
I wish he wouldn't have retired, though, but that's the way it goes. He'll come back.
He's a great guy, great personality, and no, I don't want to marry him.
After Eric Bischoff fired him from WCW, Steve Austin wasted no time in debuting for ECW. In September of 1995, in his first ever appearance in Middleton, New York, he entered the arena to the grand musical stylings of Jesus Christ Superstar. he performed a hilarious and infamous funny parody of Hulk Hogan, complete with bandana, mustache, weightlifting belt, and yellow Steve-a-mania shirt. He used the word brother over and over again. He asserted that Steve Austin was not good enough to cut it in the WCW, brother. And by the end of the interview, Austin had fittingly christened himself Superstar Steve Austin and completely shattered the notion that he did bland promos. His first goal was to win the ECW heavyweight title from the Sandman, which he surely would have had if it wasn't for McMahon and the World Wrestling Federation knocking on the future Stone Cold's door.
Austin looks to be in great shape for somebody who had a four-month layoff from a torn tricep. Mikey once again dropped across the guardrail. Steve Austin toying with our World Heavyweight Champion. It would seem he is just moments away from becoming, finally, a World Heavyweight Champion. Reversal on the Irish Whip! Austin fires back. Mikey now. Mikey with left and right. Roundhouse haymakers. And the Extreme Superstar is down. Austin wants Mikey to back off. Trying to use the injury. Mikey will have none of it. And now the fans are behind Mikey Whipwreck. And pointing to that torn tricep. Mikey doesn't want to hear it. Mikey pummeling the challenger. Reversal once again. Mikey shot in. He hit the stun gun. That's it. It's over. That's his pet finishing maneuver. That's his go-to. Mikey is done. Steve Austin hit the stun gun. Hooks the leg. Mikey gets the left shoulder up. Mikey Whipwreck kicked out of the stun gun. Unbelievable. Austin really frustrated now with chops and punches all over Mikey Whipwreck. Austin may be punching himself out. Mikey shot in. Sunset flip. Mikey pulls down the tights. He's got a Moon over Philadelphia. He got him! Mikey wins! Mikey wins! Mikey Whipwreck just pinned Steve Austin in the middle of the ring. Austin clotheslines Mikey.
There were so many notable events in 1995 for ECW, as February gave fans both the double table show featuring the main event of Sabu and the Tasmaniac against the Public Enemy, Chris Benoit versus Al Snow, and the return of the Funker featuring Terry Funk's return after a six-month absence. April of that year had the debut of the two-and-a-half-year storyline, like we said, of Raven and Tommy Dreamer, and the first match actually billed as a three-way dance with the Public Enemy versus Chris Benoit and Dean Malenko for Tasmaniac and Rick Steiner. Another arena show 1 week later brought the first of the classic Eddie Guerrero-Dean Malenko matches, in which we saw for the next 5 months. The spring also brought the psychotic bloodletting of Axel Rotten and Ian Rotten matches. The matches involved barbed wire baseball bats all the way to the tap-high death match in July, with each man having glass glued to his hands.
The most violent matches in ECW were easily the Axel Rotten versus Ian Rotten matches. In fact, those matches paved the way for all the ultra-violent and hardcore stuff that you see nowadays.
That was probably the most extreme thing I'd ever seen. I mean, I'd never seen anything like that, I think, at that point, honestly.
And there's never any real thought put into them or any kind of booking put into them. It was just more throw them out there, and if they want to put glass on their fist, you know, let them do it.
To me, it was a little too much. But I guess the crowd didn't think so, because they were enjoying every single minute of it. And that's whenever I knew that times were changing a lot.
Ian and I, you know, we teamed for, you know, a good solid year or year and a half before we split and started doing our you know, ultra crazy violent. In my eyes, and in the eyes of the fans, which is the most important, let me clarify, in the eyes of the fans, what defined the violent era of ECW, what was the definitive history-making matches, was Axel versus Ian in that series of matches that started, you know, in late 94, you know, and it ended in the summer of 95. I had grown completely fed up with being a part of a tag team with Ian, and I had said, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to be on my own. And Paul came to me and said, well, if we're going to do this, you know, we're going to have to do something where you guys split up. And, you know, I was like, well, that's fine with me. You know, I just don't want to be a part of this tag team anymore. I want to, you know, do something on my own. And he devised the idea of, we wrestle the Pit Bulls, and a losing team must split up. And we lose, we split up, and we go into doing these series of matches. Now, mind you, the first ever barbed wire baseball bat match that we did, we're swinging bats at each other, getting them stuck in our legs, you know, cutting our arms up, you know, look at, you know, just completely just decimating ourselves, you know, for the good of what we thought, you know, ECW was. I mean, the old Goo Goo Doll song, you know, scars are souvenirs you never lose, you know, and these are all souvenirs of, you know, ECW, you know, something that, you know, as much as I may try to forget, all I have to do is look at my right arm to remember that we did those type of matches, not from a blueprint, but from, we invented it as it happened. We were redefining what hardcore wrestling was. We were inventing, in a sense, a new way of ultra-violent hardcore wrestling that no one had ever seen.
He really was a hell of a worker, so it was a shame that he never got to move past, you know, the whole hardcore thing.
Blood and Guts was always on the undercard, and it seemed like in 95, towards the summer, it kind of moved up to the main events. Raven and Dreamer were brawling in the main events. Mick Foley and Sandman were having barbed wire matches in the main events. Paul Heyman knew what he was doing because it helped make the company a lot of money.
On August 29th, the Dean Malenko-Eddie Guerrero farewell match happened, with the smartest wrestling audience in North America in tears, not to mention Guerrero and Malenko themselves. They chanted, please don't go, with a heartfelt passion by the crowd, worthy of two departing world-class talents and world-class people as they moved on to World Championship Wrestling. September featured one of the top matches in arena history, as fans witnessed such matches as Rey Mysterio, Junior Psychosis, Terry Funk, Tommy Dreamer versus Cactus Jack, and Raven. The fall of 95 also brought Lucha Libre to Philadelphia for the first time, with Rey Mysterio Jr., Juventud Guerrera, Psychosis, Conan, and La Parca appearing.
He called me and he asked me about Rey and Psychosis, and I said, with all due respect to the other wrestlers in your company, they will blow away anything you have, you know, when you bring them in. So he brought them in, and anybody that knows Paulie knows he very rarely answers his phone. Well, he was waiting for my call because I told him I was going to call him to find out how the match went. He was like, tremendous, bring him back next week, every week, you know, and he, and can I have more? And that's when, you know, we brought in La Parca and Juventud. And, you know, when I first started there, I was doing Lucha Libre still. So I told him, why don't you take Crazy? And Crazy went down to ECW and just became an instant phenomenon.
Well, of course, in the early days of ECW, that was probably one of the first, I would say probably one of the first times that, like, Psychosis and Juventud had a lot of TV exposure in the States. Super Crazy is one of the best Mexican wrestlers in the world.
I think he always gave 100%, much like Sabu, and his style was just, it was Mexican. It was everything they wanted to see: dives, backflips, cool spots. He epitomized everything they wanted to see in a luchador. And I think the greatest compliment was when he would go to the corner and all the fans would count to 10 in Spanish.
They got more exposure. I think it had a lot of influence on a lot of the guys.
Some other names seen in ECW during the 1995 days were Hack Myers, Al Snow, Blandria, V. Richards, Hector Guerrero, Monetti, D.C. Drake, Jason Knight, Ron Simmons, The Vampire Warrior, a.k.a. Gangrel, Dudley Dudley, Dances with Dudley. As 95 came to a close, the ECW fan base started to rise, and the Extreme Revolution was in full storm.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
it's time to thank the sponsors of Beyond the Bell. They help bring your Pro Wrestling Nostalgia podcast to you each and every week. Barbershop Window, the place that makes wrestling t-shirts cool again to wear. Yes, you could wear a wrestling t-shirt out in public. They release brand new designs every single week. You name it, they carry it. They are hip, they are cool, no joke. Follow them at BShopWindow on Twitter and go to barbershopwindow.com now and make your wrestling wardrobe cool again. SNSRadioNetwork.com, your home for everything related to professional wrestling, mixed martial arts, video gaming, and sci-fi. Get all the latest news and listen to innovative audio released daily. So go to SNSRadioNetwork.com now. If you're not listening, you're not trying. Combat Zone Wrestling on DVD. The ultra-violent wrestling promotion can be seen on your TV or on your computer, smartphone, or tablet. You can purchase all CZW ultra-violent events, stream them live straight on your desktop computer at czwrestling.com. Get ready to get ultra-violent with CZW. The NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance. Tried, tested, honored, and of course, revered. You can catch the NWA nationwide through multiple affiliates from coast to coast. The NWA, history, tradition, and respect. Go to nwawrestling.org now, preserving tradition and blazing new paths. Connect socially to Beyond the Bell via Twitter and tout at Sean Beckerman. Become a fan of Beyond the Bell on Facebook under the BTB fan page. All audio and video clips can be seen under the YouTube channel Ring Announcing for Beyond the Bell. You can download all of the archive shows at ringannouncing.com as well as snsradionetwork.com. You smartphone users, download all archive shows directly via iTunes, the Stitcher app, and TuneIn Radio. Like the SNS Radio Network, if you're not listening, you're not trying. Want to become a sponsor of Beyond the Bell? Contact us at btbwrestling@gmail.com or beckerman@ringannouncing.com, put under the title Advertising. Join the Beyond the Bell revolution now as we go back to rewind and relive all things retro in wrestling. Classic, old school, you name it, it's Beyond the Bell on the SNS Radio Network. All right, my hardcore old school fanatics, that wraps up another edition of the Pro Wrestling Nostalgia Podcast known as Beyond the Bell. Chapter 2 closes its books. 1994 and 1995 have been archived, explained, and remembered. And we look forward to Chapter 3 of our ECW 101 series. 95 was a big year for ECW, and 96 was sure to be more of the same for the hardcore revolutionary group known as Extreme Championship Wrestling. Time to take it home and go for the three count with some old school music. This theme was the original theme used for ECW Hardcore TV. Not only was this theme used for ECW TV as the intro, but it was also used as the theme song for the Pitbulls, Pitbull number 1 and Pitbull number 2. Thunderkiss 65 by White Zombie coming up here on Beyond the Bell. Until next week, old school fans, this is your personal ring announcer, Sean Beckerman, signing off, and I'll see you at the matches. Well, we a little sister's hot tail, she's not
want to try me?
Standing by in our studios right now with comments regarding the tag team matchup, the main event this Saturday night. One half of that gigantic tag team matchup. We go now to Ron Simmons and Two Cold Scorpio.
You know, Ron, Two Cold and Ron Simmons in the mother, in the house. You know what I'm saying? This Saturday night, November the 19th, we're taking you straight to the extreme. Shane Douglas, Stunning Steve Austin, and Sherry Martel. Well, let me tell you something. I got something for your ass. Over and over again and back and forth again. But I tell you what, don't get the wrong idea. Because if you stick your nose where it don't belong, I will slap you right dead in the face. I ain't never hit a woman, but do you call yourself one?
You ain't never, but bro, I have, and slapped a many of them, and we'll continue to slap a many of them. Ooh. And Sherry Martel will be the first one that I will hit if she gets in the way. That shows you something about them punks, doesn't it? Somebody that was stripping a sorority house, bring somebody like Sherry Martel with them in their corner. Oh, that is somebody to cover your back. Brother, can you believe that? Listen to me. We're not going to take you in the ring. We're going to take you to the streets. The hood, the hardcore stuff. Where you're scared to drive to, you know what I'm saying? Drive-by stuff that you get so frightened of. Yeah. Raised up eating off the silver platter. We scared to go in those neighborhoods. But guess what? When you get in that ring, I'm going to give you just what the taste of that is like. What hardcore living is like. What it's like to be raised up as a fighter. You understand that? Now you bring this woman. Bring her, making her look elegant. Have her to do some all that stupid, treacherous, filling them stuff that she does. And see if Ron Simmons don't slap her right into the next century. Okay? The same thing that I'm going to do this Saturday to you and Steve Austin. I am going to... Did I get that right? Is it Steve Austin? Or who is it? Steve who?
I think it's Austin.
Well, whoever it is. Yeah. Steve Martin. Funny man. I don't care. Bring them all. It don't make no difference to me. Hey, listen to me.
Hey, brother, wait. You think Steve Austin can handle this? This is to the extreme. Bro, this ain't the WCW.
Extreme?
Yeah, this is to the extreme. You know what
extreme.
I'm saying? Take him to the hood.
Man, they ain't got no idea what extreme is. I am extreme. I am extreme. Ask anybody. I've taken punks like you and literally eaten them for breakfast. You hear me? Ask anybody. Look in the record books and see if Ron Simmons ain't right now. All-American, retired jersey. You know why? Because I've taken little pale punks like you and took them in my hands and literally put them in my mouth. And that's exactly what I'm going to do this Saturday. Now, when you get in that ring, you better have your behind ready to fight.
Now, tell me this. Do I have the man or do I have the man to watch my back? You know what I'm saying? Because all this bullshit going on down here in ECW.
Oh, it's
about people fornicating. Want to try to help the Mr. Franchise out, Mr. Shane
over.
Douglas.
It'll never be
this Saturday night.
Things
your butt
now. Just
is
like
on the line.
For the WCW when I became the put that belt on. Oh, they said it would never happen.
Never.
Made a lot of people mad to see me walk out there with that belt on. But guess what I did? Made
happy.
Them even madder because I went out there and continued to kick ass. And that's what I'm going to do this Saturday.
Well, Rod, you know, straight from the heart, man, if you couldn't kick no ass, I would ask you to watch my back.
Well, listen,
you know what I'm saying?
I came into the world doing it, and they know it. I ain't got nothing. That's it.
Well, then let's do that.
It's all over.
Hey, this Saturday night, November the 19th, when it's all said and done, whoop, there it is. And we gone.